Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Disrespect welcomes Christopher Reagan, an economics professor at McGill University in Montreal. He's going to talk to us about the likelihood of slow growth and the possibility of stimulus through unemployed people's incomes. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Okay. We've talked about the crises that we've undergone, and we've examined your point of view on that you think the crisis is maybe past us. What your concern is in this quote in Today's Globe, Monday, September 12th, what's almost as bad, frankly, as chugging along at, say, 1.5% growth. Meanwhile, the labor force is growing at 1%, so that means unemployment starts to rise. Now, you've postulated stimulating the economy through supplying money that flows right through the unemployed into the market, and you brought up that while we're also in an enviable position from many countries' position in the world, we're still looking at possibly rising unemployment. Do you see the two linked?
Well, let me put this comment in the context. We certainly, in the past several weeks, we have seen a lot of evidence that that the United States economy, the Canadian economy, are slowing down. There certainly seems to be continued financial market jitters, or worse, coming from Europe.
Right.
So I think we are starting to put, the profession set of forecasters, policymakers, are starting to put more probability on a near future that instead of, you know, coming back to 2.5 or 3% growth in national income, which
right.
is GDP, might look more like 1.5% or 1.8% or 2%, so a slower rate of growth. Mm-hmm. Finance Minister Jim Flaherty, I heard him say recently in an interview that, you know, while growth is fragile and the recovery is fragile, it still looks like we're going to have positive growth, and
okay.
you know, that's clearly better than zero, and
yeah.
he's absolutely right.
Yeah.
My concern is that if we come to expect
mm-hmm.
1.5 growth over the next few years, if that comes to be a reasonable description of the future,
mm-hmm.
You know, we still live in a world where the population is growing at roughly 1% in Canada, and so the labor force, aside from aging issues, the labor force is growing roughly along in line with that.
Well, and older workers' opportunities are trying to be extended by the government right
fair
now,
enough.
Too. So.
So we may be moving into a situation where growth remains positive, but it doesn't remain high enough to be absorbing that growing labor force.
Okay.
And even though the labor force may be growing at in the near future, may be growing at a slower rate than in the recent past,
mm-hmm.
it's still going to be growing.
Okay.
And that means we may observe unemployment rates rising. I mean, I hope we don't.
Right.
But this is a problem that the United States has been having, and they are still having, is that the whatever growth they've got is not fast enough to actually absorb their growing labor force, and their unemployment rate has remained fairly high. Ours is lower than the United States, but it isn't falling very quickly,
right.
and may stop falling and may start rising. And that's my concern.
Okay.
And then that, of course, gets you to the question of, well, if we're going to have slower growth rather than faster, should we provide more government stimulus?
Okay.
And we could talk about monetary policy stimulus. We could talk about fiscal stimulus.
Can you just
briefly, we could talk about other things.
As an anecdote, can you just briefly characterize monetary versus fiscal for the listener?
Well, monetary policy is what is done in this country by the Bank of Canada. That's the central bank.
Okay.
And so,
so it has to do with money supply.
Yeah, it happens to do with money supply, but we don't usually talk about it in terms of the money supply. We usually talk about it in terms of the central bank targeting a very short-term interest rate,
okay,
an overnight interest rate.
Okay.
And so, you know, if the Bank of Canada, for example, makes an announcement every 6 or 8 weeks about where they are going to target the overnight interest rate, and just last week, I guess it was, they said they would remain, at least for the next 6 or 8 weeks, they would remain targeting 1%.
Okay.
And then other interest rates kind of feed off that interest rate.
Right.
And so one question going forward is if the economy doesn't speed up and if unemployment does rise, then, you know, will the Bank of Canada actually lower interest rates?
All right.
So that's one option.
Right. Then there was fiscal policy.
Then there's fiscal policy. So that is now, you know, Jim Flaherty in the Department of Finance deciding whether at this point it could be trying to stimulate the economy through tax cuts or it could be stimulating the economy through greater government spending.
All right.
And there are problems, in my view, given our current situation, there are some problems with both monetary and fiscal stimulus. Would you like me to talk about that? Well, the problem with monetary policy at this point is that if, in fact, we are in this very fragile recovery, where there's perhaps not very much confidence, there's a lot of what is called deleveraging going on in the Canadian economy and elsewhere. So this is people digging out from being under debt, whether we're talking about corporations or banks or households.
All right.
So if that is what the recovery is going to look like over the next few years, and there's some fairly compelling evidence that recoveries after financial crises tend to be slower and longer than recoveries after just run-of-the-mill recessions.
Okay.
And if that's the case, then we can expect slower growth, and we can maybe expect unemployment to either remain high for a while or maybe even rise.
Okay.
And in that world, if confidence is low, and that's a key point, if confidence remains low, it may be the case that a further cut in interest rates by a quarter or half a percentage point, it would help, but it may not help that much because interest rates, the cost of borrowing, may not be the most important binding constraint for either firms to do investment or families to build new homes. There may be other concerns.
There's not a lot of room for a dramatic change either at 1%.
And there's not. That's right. So my sense is that while monetary policy might help, we might expect it, in this context, monetary policy to be less powerful than usual.
All right.
So then you look over back to Jim Flaherty and say, well, maybe we should do, you know, year three of a fiscal stimulus. So
All
as you know, the budgets of 2009 and 10 were pretty aggressive fiscal stimulus budgets. A little bit of action on the tax side, but most of it was on the temporary government spending to finance infrastructure, et cetera.
Right.
Well, one of the problems with that, I think it works in the sense that it injects spending into the economy. The problem is that using fiscal policy to stabilize the economy or to try to increase the growth rate of the economy requires your policies to be fairly timely. And one of the problems with fiscal policy always is that, you know, it's hard to do it when you need it. So if the federal government were to decide to have, you know, phase three of a fiscal stimulus package and decided to devote a bunch of new spending to infrastructure, the problem is you don't just, you know, there aren't existing plans for projects just ready to go.
That's what they wanted the last time, right? Shovel-ready projects.
Shovel-ready project. Well, shovel-ready projects would be great if you just happen to have shovel-ready projects.
Yeah, right.
But you don't generally have a, you know, I don't think, I never certainly met the civil servant in Ottawa who has a drawer full of environmentally cleared design plans all ready to go, and all they require is some money.
Yeah.
So once you decide to spend, you then have to come up with a project. You then have to design the project. You have to, you know, and design is not an immediate thing. So you have to design it. You have to get whatever environmental clearances need to be done. And the project just takes a while. And it may well be the case that that project really only comes online 6 or 9 months down the road. And maybe by then, the economy is already in its own recovery.
So it doesn't have the effect you intended.
Well, it doesn't have the stimulative effect now.
Yeah.
So then you say, well, okay, is there some other option for fiscal policy?
Right.
And one other option is to try to put, through one mechanism or another, try to put money just directly in the hands of people. So you could do this by making welfare payments more generous, and that right. would be directed right at low-income people.
Right.
And they would tend to spend a fair chunk of what they get.
Yeah, they're not investors.
Because they tend to spend a fair chunk of their disposable income.
Yeah.
You could also do it through more generous unemployment insurance payments, or we now call it employment insurance payments.
Right.
And not only would that likely be a quicker injection of spending in the economy, so that's
right.
good,
right.
but it would also be aiming your policy really directly at the people who are probably the most vulnerable.
Yeah.
Low-income people, people who are either low-income, not because of employment, but, I mean, they're in a situation where they're getting Canada assistance, so it's welfare.
Right.
Or they are low-income because they have lost their job and they're continuing to look for jobs, so you can at least make that process of finding a new job a little bit less painful.
Yeah.
But there's one big problem with this.
Right.
And that is, if you wanted to do this in a temporary way, I mean, yeah. let's suppose the Minister of Finance yeah. said, let's increase the generosity of UI, by X percent for a year.
Right.
Well, that feels good for a year. Mm-hmm. And then a year later, when you pull it away, mm-hmm. there is likely to be an outcry.
Mm-hmm.
And so reversing those kinds of increases in generosity for welfare or UI, it would be politically very, very difficult. So the problem is there's no option, at least that I've talked about, that is, guaranteed to work with no problems. They've all got problems associated with it.
Didn't the government get around it by extending UI temporarily?
They did, and when it came to, as I recall, and I may be wrong on this, but as I recall, when they came to then kind of reverse those changes,
right.
the first time they delayed it. Yeah. Why? Because because it would have been politically unpopular to do so.
Yeah.
So it's just always difficult to do. It doesn't mean it can't be done, but it's just difficult to do.
Okay.
So I think there is a good reason that we should be putting. Let me come back to my characterization of the next 2 or 3 years as very likely to be a slow growth recovery. If that's the way we see it, then I think there is good reason for us to just be thinking more and to be putting more policy emphasis on let me call it the vulnerable people, the unemployed
okay.
or the people, very low-income people, because those are the people that are likely to bear the burden of that.
And on that note, George Thorogood's had enough of that bull. He's Chicago-bound.
The woman I love and said, please don't go. But I left that town. You know I left that town. When I left out of Georgia, no, was Memphis bound. So I stayed in Memphis back in 69. The woman I was loving didn't baby no mind. I left that town. You know I left that town. When I left out of Memphis, you know I was St. Louis bound. We'll be right back. the greatest place I ever known. I'm gonna stay in that town. I'm gonna live in this town. I'm gonna live in Chicago, the greatest place around. Good time. I'm gonna stay in this town. I'm gonna live in this town. I'm gonna stay in Chicago, the greatest place around. I love it.
You've been listening to Christopher Reagan, an economics professor at McGill University in Montreal and a guest academic at the finance department in 2009 to 2010. Tell us about the likelihood of growth slow enough to be unable to absorb new entrants to the employment market in Canada, and the benefits of a return to stimulus, such as by putting money in the hands of people without jobs.
You know, the people, the 90% of the labor force who still, 93% of the labor force who still have their jobs, as long as they keep employed at an unchanged income,
yeah,
you know, a recession doesn't hurt them that much.
All right.
Financial market volatility hurts some of them.
Yeah.
But if you still have your job, then a recession doesn't look that bad. But if you are one of the unlucky 7 or 8%,
yeah,
who've lost your job and perhaps are still looking for a job,
yeah,
you're the ones that are really going to be hurt.
Yeah.
And if we're not going to bounce back out of this recession quickly, then maybe we should be putting more emphasis in our policies on the labor market.
Yeah, making sure as much as we can that people don't lose jobs.
And that if you can prevent them from losing jobs, that's one thing. But also, while they're searching, if you can make that search a little bit less painful.
Right. What do you think of the point of view that extending or enlarging unemployment benefits also extends and enlarges unemployment?
Well, I mean, the way unemployment insurance works, or I you can tell my age, I should call it employment insurance, but
okay.
It takes a long time to learn that new trick. The way employment insurance works is that by either lengthening the time for which an unemployed worker gets payments or increasing the dollar value of the payment, it makes it less difficult to remain unemployed.
All right.
So it probably makes, for some searching workers, they will be less likely to accept their first job offer or their second job offer. They're more likely to wait for the appropriate job offer. So there's both good and bad with that. On the one hand, it probably allows better job matching. I mean, we don't want unemployed workers to just accept the first job that comes along.
Right.
We want them to accept the right job.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, the yeah, more well, generous
how much,
is the...
How much tax do you get from an engineer working at McDonald's when he could be working for an aerospace company?
Well, just, I mean, having an engineer flipping burgers just seems to me to be kind of a misallocation of resources, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the engineering company wants an engineer, and the engineer probably wants to be hired by an engineering company, and that's an appropriate job match.
Yeah.
So one benefit of unemployment insurance for society is that we get better job matches.
Okay.
But one cost of unemployment insurance for society is that we may get people searching a little too long, waiting a little bit too long, getting a little bit too choosy, if you like.
All right.
So how you draw the, I mean, so setting the appropriate level of employment insurance payments is about striking that balance. I'm not a specialist on unemployment insurance,
yeah.
So I don't know if we're exactly at that balance.
Mm-hmm. In an economy where there are no jobs, such as maybe the American economy, it strikes me that that is less likely that people are going to be choosy. They're just going to want a job. Certainly, if it's possible to pick a better job than the low offer on the totem pole, they will. But they're not going to hang around looking for jobs when they have one, and they know that nobody else has got one.
Well, that may be true. I think you're probably right that the longer somebody remains unemployed, the more willing accept a job offer. However, there's something else that works in the other direction, is that the longer somebody becomes remains unemployed, it may get harder to get another job offer because maybe your skills have deteriorated during that time that you've been unemployed.
Well, and people begin to wonder, even McDonald's begins to wonder, why have you been out of work so long?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So longer-term unemployment, and the United States and Canada historically have not had a large fraction of their unemployment be long-term unemployment.
That's true.
Typically, they've been very good, very flexible labor markets in that sense, is that we had a fair amount of turnover in labor markets. And so not only do we have low unemployment rates, typically, relative to, say, countries in Western Europe,
but a
smaller fraction of our unemployment was long-term. Well, in the United States, in the last 2 years, we've seen an increase in long-term unemployment. We've seen we've seen an increase in Canada as well, but not as much.
Right.
I think this is a bigger issue in the United States today than it is in Canada.
Yeah.
But just going forward, again, if we're going to have 1.5 or 1.8% growth of real GDP for the next 3 years instead of getting back to 2 and 2.5 and 3, if that's what we're going to have, then this may become a bigger issue in our near future.
Yeah. So you're saying that their unemployment rate is quite a bit higher than ours, but if ours starts to grow, we can't count on that remaining the case.
That's right.
And in that case, we could consider a judicious stimulus by accommodating the vulnerable.
Yes, and I think it's interesting. Last weekend, I saw a newspaper just recently in the last few days where Prime Minister Stephen Harper was talking about focusing on unemployment, focusing on the labor market.
Yeah, I did too.
Being flexible in terms of fiscal stimulus. I mean, being prepared to say, we are prepared to do it if we need it. I think that's an appropriate position to take. I'm not yet convinced that we need phase three of a fiscal stimulus package.
Okay.
Counting 2009 budget as phase one and 2010 budget as phase two. But if we need it, I think we should do it. And one thing that's certainly true is that Canada's public debt position is much lower than in most other countries. And so if there's any developed country that can afford to do more fiscal stimulus, it is us. And I'm not convinced yet that we need it, but if we do, then I would start thinking about the labor market, and that's I think one interpretation of what Prime Minister Harper was saying, is that we want to focus more on the labor market than on just injecting spending. I'm not sure he said anything specifically about infrastructure, but that's one way to interpret what he's saying.
Well, if they already funded the shovel ready projects, I mean, infrastructure looks less attractive the third time around too.
Right.
How would the federal government, what instruments can the federal government adopt to help vulnerable people in the interest of stimulating the economy?
Well, so I've mentioned two. There are others. So one is you could make welfare receipts more generous.
Well, that's provincial.
Okay.
Mind you, the funds come from the federal government through provincial transfers.
Yeah.
And that's coming up in 2014.
Yep. So the second is unemployment insurance or employment insurance. You could tweak the benefits in that system.
Okay.
Another is that you could simply look at your income tax system, and you could lower rates at the low end. You could increase the basic personal amount, the basic personal exemption.
Right.
You could make the working income tax benefit more generous, the WITBE, which was I think introduced in 2007, and it's actually quite a smart policy to try to reduce the marginal income tax rate for low income working people, and thereby provide a greater incentive for people to work. Through the income tax system, you could do it. I'm not an income tax specialist either, but there are lots of people at the Department of Finance that could come up with ways that you could actually make changes to the income tax system that would generally help low-income people.
Well, usual income tax adjustments, I think, are overrated because the most vulnerable people are generally not eligible to pay a lot of tax.
Okay,
so they need some kind of direct check or something like that,
some
kind of incentive program.
So you could make a low-income income GST tax credit a little bit more generous if you wanted to do that.
Yeah, that's true.
And, you know, and again, none of these may be perfect, although, you know, a combination of them may actually be very effective. But again, the problem, not the problem, but a problem with any of these is if you do them as a temporary measure, they're very difficult to turn around. Politically, very difficult to turn around.
Yeah. Yeah. So in a democratic society, we really don't have a way to introduce unfavorable cutbacks, do we? That's foolproof.
Well, I mean, if you're going to introduce a budget to, you know, to make the EI benefits more generous, you can also introduce a budget a year later to make them less generous. You can do it.
Yeah.
But politically, you should expect some opposition to that.
Well, yeah, it strikes me then you need a kind of a package of benefits geared to potentially rising employment and rising incomes so that the benefits move up the income scale as the populace moves up the income scale, something like that, so that you're taking more money from the people you're giving benefits to as time goes on, and in effect, reducing the benefit because you're... You know,
basically clawing back the benefit as their personal situation improves.
Yeah.
You can do that, and then that requires a fair amount of design, you know, before you do it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I don't think any of this is easy. I mean, things that are, you know, things that are technically easy are often politically difficult.
Okay.
Things that are politically easy are often technically difficult.
Oh, okay.
And so... I guess that's just a general property that there's general example of the general property that there's no free lunch in life.
Yeah, that's an interesting conundrum for someone who's looking for stimulus to flow through vulnerable people. So, sum it up in my own perception, you wouldn't bet money on a second turndown, and you wouldn't bet money at this point on the need for further stimulus. But if there were... You would look forward to stimulus of the vulnerable, the unemployed, as a best way to pump money into the economy. And the question then becomes how to get it back when the stimulus is no longer required. What can even through inflation, could you get it back? Or,
you know, the Bank of Canada is doing its best to keep inflation low and stable.
Yeah.
At about 2%.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good thing for it to be doing.
Right.
And so, I mean, they can do that while they are providing monetary stimulus during a recession, as they have been doing.
Right.
So I don't think we want a situation where we increase the inflation rate, especially.
Yeah.
I don't think we get significant gains from that. I certainly don't think it really helps the problem of the low-income people or the unemployed people.
No. Okay. So, yeah, the problem remains then clawing back these potential stimulus benefits, but it may be a luxury that we have to accept we don't have a solution for now if we need that stimulus then, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, possibly in the future, possibly in the near future, depending on which way the American and European economies go.
Well, we'll have a fall fiscal update.
When will that be?
We usually do.
When will that be?
I would expect it to be sometime in the latter half of October. I think that's kind of a typical time for this.
All right.
So there, you know, the government may provide some hints, then they might actually do something.
Okay.
But then we have a budget in March. So, you know, one of the things I learned when I was at the Department of Finance visiting for a year and a half is that the budget can change and does change pretty much up to the last minute, you know, the last 48 hours.
Okay.
And so, a lot can happen between now and middle of January.
Yeah.
And if the economy is looking a lot worse, then, you know, I think that gives you a set of predictions for what the March budget will look like. Yeah. But if by January things have picked up and the forecasts are looking pretty good at that point, that gives you a different prediction about what to expect in the March budget.
Well, then you have to factor in, I guess the finance department has got that locked down, but then you have to factor in the big slump right after Christmas, right?
Well,
so they would do seasonally adjusted.
You know, hopefully that's just a seasonal blip.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking about longer term, medium, what I guess we would call a medium term projection.
Okay.
So, you know, if U.S. growth is looking better, if the European financial situation is looking better, and I'm not, you know, holding my breath for that, but in 4 months, I mean, I just think back to the last 8 weeks, I think our tone about the world economy is considerably more negative today than it was 8 weeks ago. Well, yeah. that suggests to me that 8 weeks from now or 16 weeks from now, our tone could be either a lot more negative than it is today or, in fact, a lot more positive than it is today. I mean, things do change.
Okay.
And
so,
things can change fairly quickly.
So as the citizens of an exporting country, even the vulnerable, even people who are unemployed or people who are marginally employed or people who are on welfare, if they want to read the future, one of the clues they can get is they should look at the economies of the world around us.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, Canada is not, as both Harper and Flaherty have said, Canada is not an island.
Right.
You know, we did very well in the financial crisis. We experienced the financial crisis, but not to the same extent that it was felt in Europe and the United States. We experienced a recession that at the beginning, in terms of GDP, looked actually pretty much like what was felt in the United States. But on the labor market side, it was considerably less painful. But we still do most of our trade with the United States.
Yeah.
And so it is inconceivable to me that the United States could have a either stagnant economy or a double dip, and it wouldn't influence us. The logic within me tells me it's got to influence us, because if they're not buying, you know, car parts and machine tools and houses and furniture, then chances are they're not buying a lot of that stuff from us.
Right.
And so that's going to be a reduction in demand for our exports, and that's very important for us.
Yeah. So it's a good news, bad news story. I mean, for the vulnerable people, if the world economy deteriorates, Canada's economy probably deteriorates, although maybe not a proportional amount. And they might see short-term stimulus in the form of some support for the vulnerable in our society. But the long-term picture is, if the world economy deteriorates, our job opportunities deteriorate for a while.
I would
too.
Have to agree with that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good news, bad news. Okay.
And remember, the only reason the good news is in that story is because of the bad news.
That's
right.
That's right. Okay.
Good news is the response to the bad news. So.
Okay. All right. I appreciate your making that clear for us. Is there anything else you wanted to say about this before we wrap it up?
No, I'm sure I've talked far more than I should have.
No, I think you brought us to a very interesting picture of what's going on and how it will affect the vulnerable people as opposed to working people. And what the signs for the future are. No, I appreciate that very much.
No, my pleasure.
All right, thanks, Christopher.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Christopher Reagan, an economics professor at McGill University in Montreal and a guest academic at the finance department in 2009 to 2010. Tell us about the likelihood of growth slow enough to be unable to absorb new entrants to the employment market in Canada, and the benefits of a return to stimulus, such as by putting money in the hands of people without jobs. Before disrespect takes you to the weekly news review, let's break it with George Thorogood. Let it rock.
In the heat of the day, got a movie around the middle, working on a rail with a steel dollar hammer. I gotta find some money, buy some brand new shoes. Gotta find a woman, chase away my blues. She don't love me when I'm singing in the sun. All done, yeah. In the evening when the sun is sinking low, all they have been waiting for the whistle.
you remember. Now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These aren't the verbatim stories we read to you from the news outlets, but condensed versions adapted for Disrespect's news review. Hudak won't say if he'd freeze hydro rates. Ottawa. Progressive Conservative leader Tim Hudak is promising to reduce taxes on electricity but refuses to say whether hydro rates will continue to climb under a Tory government. While condemning the Liberals for driving up the cost of power, Hudak would not commit to holding the line on increases. A senior energy industry source told The Star that Hudak knows electricity costs will continue to rise for a number of reasons, no matter who is in power. Asked specifically if he'd guarantee the rates would not climb if the Tories win on October 6th, Hudak refused to answer, but was quick to add that the provincial portion of the HST would be cut. People across Ontario know that the hydro bill has become a laundry list of Dalton McGuinty's tax grabs, energy experiments, and outrageous wastes, he said. The Liberals brought in a 10% rebate to blunt the sharp rise because of the HST and other infrastructure costs. Brad Duguid, McGuinty's energy minister, defended the Liberals' rate increases, saying the government had to rebuild the energy system after years of neglect under the Tories. That by Richard Brennan, national affairs writer in the Toronto Star. Now, you kids go back to your room and no more fighting. Global revolt of the have-nots. The Arab Spring that turned into a bloody summer. Protests in Europe culminating in riots in London and elsewhere in Britain. Demonstrations across Israel. Unrest even in faraway Chile and India. Though it's possible to point to causes unique to each country, they all seem to have in common a revolt against the ever-growing gap between the haves and the have-nots. As Thomas Friedman put it in a recent New York Times column, anger is being globalized. A black British social activist, Merlin Emanuel, said, "We call them criminals, and they look at the bankers. We call them violent murderers, and they look at the police. We say they're void of morals and integrity, they look at the politicians." His references are, of course, to the money managers who've misappropriated billions entrusted to them, yet only occasionally ended up in jail, to instances of police brutality, and to the British MPs who cheated on their expenses. As blacks are often among the angriest, also in Britain, Emmanuel writes magnanimously that he understands the fears articulated by the far right. But then he asks, do blacks own poppy fields and gun factories? And later, is it black people who outsource your jobs to foreign territories and then open up borders to immigrants who will compromise your right to earn a decent living by working for peanuts? Mercifully, Canada has so far been spared, but we're by no means immune to their problems. The gap between rich and poor is not diminishing here, and the continuous onslaught by all levels of government on the funding of welfare agencies is bound to punish those most in need. Prudence, humility, and social responsibility, not smugness, are called for. As we think of our own vulnerability manifest in the unrest in Toronto a year ago and in Vancouver last June. That by Dow Marmur, Rabbi Emeritus at Toronto's Holy Blossom Temple in the Toronto Star. Rich versus poor gap exploding. Canada is becoming a nation of haves and have-nots as the gap between rich and poor is increasing at the fourth fastest pace out of 17 developed countries, according to a Conference Board of Canada report. Since the mid-1990s, the income gap here has been widening faster than that of the United States, currently the country with the biggest disparity between rich and poor, the report said. High inequality both raises a moral question about fairness and can contribute to social tensions, said Anne Golden, President and Chief Executive of the Conference Board. In Canada, the gap between the rich and poor has widened over two decades, especially compared to our peer countries. Most of that wealth is tied up in homes, with property accounting for over half of the gain, StatsCan said. And that in the 24-hour News Canada free newspaper by the QMI agency. Alleged conspirators ask for jury trials. Amid tight security, 17 accused of disrupting last year's G20 appear at a preliminary hearing. 15 months after the tumultuous G20 summit in Toronto, the preliminary inquiry for 17 people accused of conspiring to disrupt it has begun in the city's North End. Most of the 17 defendants are in their early 20s and are variously accused of conspiring to commit mischief, obstruct police, resist arrest, and with counseling to assault police. All have pleaded not guilty to the charges, which are being prosecuted by a team of lawyers attached to the Toronto Police Service's Guns and Gangs Task Force. One by one, each accused told the court that if the charges go to trial, they want to be tried by a judge and jury. The 17 people now before the courts are all free on bail, and most were cheerful as they arrived, departed, and briefly addressed the court. Two of the defendants, 30-year-old Alex Hundert and Amanda Hiscox, 37, are under what they view as particularly severe restrictions, including a prohibition on taking part in public demonstrations. When Mr. Hundert participated in a Ryerson University panel discussion last September, he was deemed to have violated his bail conditions and was re-arrested. As well, restrictions were placed on his ability to communicate with co-accused Leah Henderson, to whom he was engaged when they were arrested. A third bail condition, that Mr. Hundert not speak to the media, was later lifted. That by Timothy Appleby in the Globe and Mail. Ashley Smith inquest resumes, then adjourns. One more week. The often-delayed inquest into the prison death of troubled New Brunswick teen Ashley Smith was delayed for another week Monday, frustrating some of those involved. The proceeding resumed under new coroner John Carlisle, but was quickly adjourned until next Monday, when a motion will be heard challenging Dr. Carlisle's jurisdiction. Noting that the inquest was supposed to have started in November 2010 and heard only 3 days of evidence in front of Dr. Porter before it was adjourned on May 16th, John McNair, representing St. Joseph's Hospital in London, said it was time to get on with the hearing. Dr. Carlisle still needs to deal with lingering issues that Dr. Porter didn't rule on, added Mr. McNair. Before she was replaced, Dr. Porter had promised to rule on 3 issues she had under reserve, including the Correctional Service of Canada's request for prison guards' faces to be blurred in videos. Another issue was whether the inquest should include videos from a Quebec prison that Ms. Smith's family says show the troubled youth being restrained and forcibly injected with medication. Ms. Smith had been in and out of custody since 2003, much of that time spent in segregation. Again, that inquest has been adjourned until this coming Monday. That by Canadian Press in the Globe and Mail in Toronto. Anger at pet policy incident. In just over a week, Victoria Nolan has gone from winning silver at the World Rowing Championships in Bled, Slovenia, to being told she and her guide dog weren't welcome at an Esso station. The 36-year-old, who has lost all but 3% of her vision to a degenerative eye disease, was with her guide dog and following her husband, Ian, into an Esso station with a coffee outlet in Toronto on Sunday when she heard a man shouting at her to leave. He started yelling, saying, "You can't come in here, there's no pets allowed in here," recalled Nolan, who's a member of the adaptive or Paralympic Canadian rowing team that won a silver medal at the World Championships that ended September 4th. She says she told the Esso employee, "This isn't a pet, it's a guide dog," and he said, "I don't care," and told her to get out. "I was shocked. He was so angry and hostile," said Nolan. "He really wasn't interested in what I said." "This is a regrettable incident," said Laura Bishop, a spokesperson for Imperial Oil, which owns Esso. "What I can tell you is our retailers are instructed to allow service dogs on our retail sites and convenience stores. We cannot allow animals that are not service animals into our stores due to health regulations." And that by Torstar News Services in the free Metro News, Wednesday, September 14th. And at the same story again in the Star, Victoria Nolan says she could complain to the city's bylaw enforcement office, but has done that in the past with other discriminatory incidents unrelated to this one. "This time she and her husband have spoken to lawyers and will be pursuing some sort of legal action. I feel like I should take this to another level. My frustration is growing. It doesn't take much or a whole lot of training to tell people this is the law. My main goal is to educate people, make it easier for others who travel with service animals." In 2009, a municipal tribunal revoked the license of a cab driver who refused Nolan and her dog. And that article by Valerie Houch, staff reporter at the Toronto Star. Disabled, strip searched, humiliated. Parkdale man, 35, accuses Toronto police of racial profiling. "We can handle this one of two ways," Constable Paul Mohit allegedly told Vaughn Nemhard as he sat handcuffed in the back of a police cruiser on Queen Street last February. "We let you go now and you forget this ever happened, or we charge you with assaulting a police officer." Nemhard thought of what his father had told him the last time he was stopped and questioned by police. "Make them put everything on the record. Take me to jail," he said. Nemhard, a 35-year-old Rogers customer service agent, is accusing Toronto police of racial profiling and discrimination after he was arrested in February for assaulting a police officer, a charge that was later dropped. Nemhard believes he was targeted by police, slapped with a bogus charge, and arbitrarily strip searched because of his skin color and the limp he has walked with since suffering a stroke 13 years ago. He said he has been questioned and harassed by police a number of times in his life. "The first time when I was 12 or 13, he said, and since he was not breaking any laws, he did not want to cooperate with them. Mohit and his partner Alexanderwitz left the car and stood in Nemhard's way, according to the complaint. They continued to ask him where he was going, where he lived, and if he was wanted. Nemhard said the officers, one white, the other Middle Eastern or South Asian, also shoved him and refused to provide their names and badge numbers. I still do not know why they were stopping me, Nemhard says in his complaint. I asked the officers if they stopped me because I am black. Both of them laughed. They still did not give a reason for stopping me. Nemhard, who has no criminal record, is seeking $250,000 in compensation for discrimination, mental and physical suffering, and injury to dignity, feelings, and self-respect. Nemhard says the incident has left him feeling degraded and humiliated, fearful of police and less productive at work. I felt kidnapped, he said, and I was just walking in my neighborhood. Said Nemhard's lawyers, Barry Squadron and Kelly Bryan, if it was a white guy with a limp, they would have said this guy has a disability. Because he's black, they assume he has a weapon. Nemhard said his experience is common to his black friends, but wants others to know too. I want people to know this happens a lot more than they think. And that in the Toronto Star by Brendan Kennedy, staff reporter. There will be a day of reckoning. Lawyer Kirk Baird is preparing to take on the provincial government in a multi-billion-dollar class action suit representing a forgotten group of Ontarians. He is confident they'll win. We're more than a match for the province, he says. The government can face reality and settle, or it can go to trial and pay three times as much. His clients are the thousands of mentally ill children and adults locked in insane asylums between 1945 and 2009. Hidden from sight and helpless, they endured decades of sadistic discipline. The first plaintiffs to step forward were two frail but brave elderly women who spent most of their lives in the Huronia Regional Center, once known as Aurelius Asylum for Idiots. They filed affidavits describing beatings, sexual abuse, and degrading forms of punishment. Their personal testimony, plus the evidence Burt and his legal team rounded up, police reports, witness accounts, newspaper exposés dating back four decades, and successive government inquiries that produced no action, convinced an Ontario Superior Court judge to certify a groundbreaking class action suit last year. Today, all of Ontario's 16 residential facilities for the mentally disabled are closed, but they left a legacy of blighted lives, damaged bodies, and appalling secrets. Baird is determined to get the whole story out in the open, get the province to acknowledge the wrong it did, and get redress for the victims. But the Toronto lawyer is not the real force behind this quest for justice. It was social worker Marilyn Domage who started the ball rolling 10 years ago. When she was a child, her younger brother was sent to Huronia with Down syndrome. He died at 8 years of age of untreated pneumonia. That motivated her to get a job at Huronia. During her 5 years on staff, she witnessed residents being medicated against their will, locked in caged cots, and punished harshly for behavior they could not control. She sounded the alarm repeatedly to inspectors, regulators, and politicians, to no avail. Finally, as a last resort, she decided on legal action. She compiled many examples of abuse, persuaded two former residents to tell their stories in court, and contacted Baird, who agreed to represent the former residents. Nothing like this has ever happened in Ontario's courts before. The province has no contingency fund to cover claims of this magnitude. The history of class action suits in the public sector is still young. What is certain, however, is that the province's next government, regardless of who heads it, will be held to account for one of the ugliest chapters in Ontario's history. And that by Carol Gore in the Toronto Star. And our final story, while not exactly good news, is maybe good news if you are not taking non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. The risk of miscarrying is 2.4 times greater for women who took any type and dosage of non-aspirin, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs in early pregnancy, according to a study in the current issue of the Canadian Medical Association Journal. Aspirin is an anti-inflammatory drug but does not cause the problems found in this study. That's a high risk, especially considering the baseline risk is considerable, lead author Dr. Annick Berard, a professor at the University of Montreal, said in an interview. Indeed, up to 15% of clinically detected pregnancies end in spontaneous abortions or miscarriages. Berard's study reveals that number jumps to 35% for pregnant women taking non-aspirin, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. The study, released Tuesday, was conducted by the University of Montreal, the Centre Hospitalier Universitaire Saint-Justine in Montreal, and the École Nationale de la Statistique et de l'Analyse de l'Information in Rennes, France. The type of drugs studied include ibuprofen and are sold under brand names such as Aleve and Celebrex. They are among the most common medications used during pregnancy. The highest risk was associated with diclofenac alone, and the lowest risk was in users of rofecoxib alone. Previous studies have shown that taking non-aspirin NSAIDs during the first trimester is also associated with birth defects. Given that the use of non-aspirin NSAIDs during early pregnancy has been shown to increase the risk of major congenital malformations, and that our results suggest a class effect on the risk of clinically detected spontaneous abortion, non-aspirin NSAIDs should be used with caution during pregnancy, the authors conclude. And that's the news this week for Disrespect, but come back next week, and we will have more. And now to take us out, Joe Louis Walker, Rollin' in a Tumblin'.
I'm
If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.